you know, our models of church life are proving themselves in many ways to be insufficient to the needs of the church today. So there is a sense in which there are things here that are ending and death is painful. We don't need to be afraid of change, but that also requires us to relinquish the power that we have been holding on to very tightly in our communities.
That was Susan Bigelow Reynolds, Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. Our interview with her about the sweeping changes happening in American parish life today follows in a moment. But first, I wanted to take the time to point out that this episode might sound a little different than usual. Like much of the rest of the country, we've been ordered indoors, and now we're producing everything, including the podcast, remotely. But as we continue to pursue our work, we hope you're staying safe and healthy in these difficult times. So from my apartment in Brooklyn, New York, I'm Dominic Preziosi, and this is the Commonweal Podcast. So today on the Commonweal Podcast, we're pleased to present the first of two special episodes on the American parish today. The April issue of our print magazine presents articles and interviews from a number of different contributors and staff members. They come from different walks of life and parochial experiences. They're men and women, clerical and lay, of different races and ethnicities and sexualities and ages. But they all want one thing: to reimagine what the Catholic parish means today. On this episode, Associate Editor Matthew Sittman speaks with Susan Bigelow Reynolds, Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. Her piece articulates one of our guiding themes. Though canon law describes parishes as stable communities of the faithful, we live in unstable times, an age of migration and movement. And then I join Audience Development Director Milton Javier Bravo for a wide-ranging conversation with Father Hector Madrigal. He's the pastor of St. Joseph's Church in Amarillo, Texas, and we talk to him about what he calls the heart work, that is, the hard but necessary work of ecclesial integration. That's all coming up right here on the Commonweal Podcast. Susan Bigelow Reynolds is Assistant Professor of Catholic Studies at Emory University's Candler School of Theology. Her essay, Way Stations for a Pilgrim Church, recounts the changes that have occurred in four parishes that have marked her life. She then folds those stories into broader trends, from the rise of Latinx Catholics to the shifting geography of the U.S. Church. Parishes are border zones, spaces of encounter, whose shifting reality we should joyfully embrace. Her conversation with Associate Editor Matt Sittman follows.
Thank you, Susan, so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
You describe your academic work as lived ecclesiology. Could you describe what that means for our listeners?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'll talk just a little bit about what led me to this. After college, I taught middle school in a small Catholic school in Brownsville, Texas. And I was living in a border community, essentially in the parish that I belonged to there, was this incredibly dynamic community that really practiced this very organic, very intense solidarity with the various immigrant communities that lived in and around the area. And when I moved to Boston a couple years later for graduate school in theology, what I like to say is I found myself living in a different kind of borderland. I was living actually in the parish house of a small parish in Roxbury, a neighborhood in Boston, that unlike most Catholic churches that are diverse in some way, really practiced this very deep intercultural community. There was a Black Catholic community, there was a Euro-American community, there was a Caribbean community, there was this very vibrant Latino community there. And there was this very deep sense of intercultural solidarity at the parish. And I was very intrigued by this because it was so different than anything that I had experienced at the parishes that I had belonged to in the past. And really digging deep into the life of that community led me to try to piece together what I like to call this lived ecclesiology, this sense of what it means to be church from the inside out. And the work that I've done sort of flowing from my time at that parish in Roxbury has really led me to this conviction that I know a lot of other people share, that we can't talk about the church unless we're talking about the lived experiences of parish communities and other small communities on the ground.
What was the general experience you had as you moved through these parishes, and how did that figure into your essay or your work more broadly?
Sure. Even as a young child, I was really captivated by the quirky particularities of parish life. I grew up in this parish south of Denver. There was just this beautiful panorama of the Front Range of the Rocky Mountains. And it was just at that time, the choir was singing Rich Mullins, and it was just this kind of beautiful, crunchy, organic sort of sacramentality that in some way really made sense. And I felt like I was able to live that really deeply as a kid. And then I spent every summer in this small town where my family, my mom's side of the family, had lived for generations in Streeter, Illinois. My family is very proud Slovak American. They belong to the first Slovak parish in the United States. So we would go and hang out with my great aunt and kind of just participate in this sort of old world Slovak parish life that also was very, very captivating to me. So I think for me, I've always just kind of had my eye on these little, I just have a lot of love for parishes. I love parish life.
Well, I think that really comes through in your essay. And one thing I like that you do is you kind of describe the parish as a site where we can discover different ways of being holy. And it might look different in different places, but how bottom up is Catholic theology in the U.S.? Situate your work in terms of how other Catholic theologians have taken up the issues you take up in your essay.
That's a great question. I think the first thing that I'll say is that change itself has really been a constant, particularly over the last 50 years. If you look at, if you go to your local university library and get every single book written on parish life since, the Second Vatican Council, all the titles are The Changing Parish, Parish in Transformation, The Church in Change. So the change itself is not something new, and many others have sort of noted that. Where I'm trying to help us to think a little bit more clearly, I want us to get out of crisis mode, I guess, when I'm talking about change. So we have these sweeping transformations that are underway in the church. We're closing parishes, we're consolidating parishes. Parishes are becoming much more diverse. And so the models of parish life are changing. The boundaries outside of the church are changing. The boundaries within the church are changing. Our geographical scope of parish life is changing. If you compare two maps together, if you sort of envision two maps in your mind, one that shows a net gain in Catholics in the United States, and the other that shows where all of our Catholic institutions and sort of infrastructure are located, they are exactly the opposite. And so all of our Catholic universities and parishes, even though they're closing, and other things, institutes, high schools, elementary schools, they're all, for the most part, located in the Midwest, in the Northeast. If you look at where the Catholic Church is growing and flourishing, it's all in the South and West. And so what you have is this kind of disparity. There's a misallocation of resources right now. The church is kind of running to catch up with itself. And finally, I talk about the shifting boundaries of, belief and practice and affiliation. People are disaffiliating from the Catholic Church. People are expecting different things of their parishes, of their parish life. So there really is this state of profound instability and change. And I think as both sociologists and also theologians don't quite know what to do with that. What I want to urge us to do is to take much more seriously, as a whole church, the work of Latino theologians, because for decades, really since, just after the Second Vatican Council, and for centuries in practice, but in terms of written theology for decades, it's been primarily Latino theologians who have been calling the church to embrace these borderlands within our midst, to recognize differences in practice and affiliation and tradition, not as reasons to feel like the church is crumbling and falling apart before our eyes, but rather as real opportunities to recognize these growing edges, to recognize the inbreaking of God's grace and revelation in our midst. So things are changing. And, in some ways we have reasons to be concerned, but I think in a much broader way, this is an opportunity for us to listen to the Holy Spirit and to kind of live in to these transformations.
The Christian story is one of kind of death and resurrection, right? You have to lose your life to gain it. What would you tell our listeners about how to lean into that? Like, what would be your advice to them if they see these changes around them, or if they are more caught up in the gloom and doom story? What's your kind of word of hope to people?
I'm recalling here a lot of the work that I've done around the sexual abuse crisis too, because throughout that, I've had the thought that this really has the capacity to become a kind of kairos moment for the church. There is a sense in which something real has died. People's patience with insufficient authority has died. You know, our models of church life are proving themselves in many ways to be insufficient to the needs of the church today. So there is a sense in which there are things here that are ending, and death is painful. You know, so when I talk about parishes, for example, where, you know, it used to be to use my own example, you know, a Slovak American community, very insular, very strong. And now, you know, there's one parish for the entire town and it's predominantly Mexican-American. There is a sense of grief there that those, you know, older Euro-American parishioners have, you know, not grief at the other coming in, but just grief at the fact that this community that they've maybe been a part of for 80 years isn't the same as it used to be. What I would encourage our listeners to do or to embrace, to lean into, you know, is that the power of these new voices that are really responsible for the transformation of the church today. I mean, I think we're very used to reading pieces and hearing about the fact that the church is coming more diverse. You know, as 40% basically of Catholics in the United States today are Latino, a very strong Asian American presence, African American, Native American Catholics. So really, Euro American Catholics are becoming a minority in the church. At the same time, we have this very stark asymmetry of power. So most positions of power, whether we're talking about ordained power or lay leadership, particularly paid lay leadership, are still held by Euro-American Catholics. The vast majority of our priests, the vast majority of our bishops, the vast majority of theologians are white, are Euro-American. So we can talk all we want about diversity, but if we're not empowering diverse Catholics, if we're not empowering Latino Catholics, if we're not empowering Asian American, Native American, African American Catholics, if we're not giving them positions of power in our parish, if we're not paying our lay leaders from those communities, then the church is going to continue to be a place where these power asymmetries prevail. So what I want to encourage our listeners to embrace is just the sense that we don't need to be afraid. We don't need to be afraid of change, but that also requires us to relinquish the power that we have been holding on to very tightly in our communities, and not just to listen, but to really empower and embrace these new voices.
That's a great way to end. And thank you very much, Susan.
Thank you.
This is Tom Baker, Common Wheels publisher. And on behalf of all of us here, I'd like to thank the supporters who made our April Parish issue and these podcasts possible, the William E. Simon Foundation, and two funds created by donors to Common Wheel, the John Garvey Fund and the Paul Saunders Fund for coverage of the church's future. If you'd like to support these podcasts and our other work with a contribution, we would be very grateful. Please visit commonwealmagazine.org/donate. Thank you.
Father Hector Madrigal is pastor of St. Joseph's Church in Amarillo, Texas. He's collaborated with the bishops on developing plans for ecclesial integration. He's head of one of the most successful shared parishes in the United States. And Milton Javier Bravo and I spoke to Father Madrigal about his experience. You've spoken in the past of wanting to increase the appreciation of all the cultures within the Amarillo Diocese and develop a stronger sense of communion among all of us. I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about the variety of the cultures you see, not only in the diocese, but at St. Joseph's, your parish specifically.
Yes, you know, I've been here 13 years at St. Joseph's, and it didn't start off with all these different groups. It slowly kind of developed. From the very beginning, we had a strong group that I would call Euro-Americans, and sometimes in this part of the country, we call them white people. But we also had another significant number of what I call integrated/assimilated Mexican-Americans. So those were the two groups. But now, 13 years later, this parish consists not only the Euro-Americans and the integrated Mexican-Americans, but we have many Mexican immigrants, and they're the largest group now. We have a significant number of families from South Sudan, We have a few Salvadorians, Bosnian refugees, and of course, Filipinos. And that's very much reflective of our diocese. The other groups in the diocese that are not in the parish is a strong group, although we have representatives from them, is the Vietnamese community. We have Burmese, Cubans, and we have a significant number of professional Filipino and Filipinos and Africans. But that's kind of the makeup. We have many, many other refugees in the diocese, but the ones that are Catholic are the ones that are identified.
You use the word appreciation of all the cultures. And how do you define or think of appreciation? I mean, in your parish at St. Joe's, what does appreciation look like and mean to you?
I think very clearly from the beginning, Dominic, we were very clear that we're called to open the doors to our church and our hearts to all the people who come to St. Joseph's. And so in order to do that, part of it, because of my background in sociology, I understood, and being a Mexican-American myself, that a culture is significant for all of us. And so I began to preach and teach and share with people about the importance of recognizing that culture is a gift, that our cultures are very beautiful, and they all have some very positive aspects and have something to contribute to the church. And so we from the very beginning, begin to learn the different cultures, the cultural gifts, and most importantly, as we see new people come in, as we begin to experience people of different cultures, that was always from the very beginning, you know, the attitude. You know, they come to us, God has brought them to into our midst, to our parish, and so we are to receive them as we receive Christ, including their way of thinking and eating and singing and praying. So their whole culture is seen as a gift.
What kind of successes have you seen in terms of realizing this sense of communion in your parish? And I guess another way of asking it might be, what are some of the challenges or difficulties or the surprises?
You know, we went through a listening session my first few years, or my first year here, and we created a mission statement that it was very prophetic. And our mission statement was simply, we welcome all God's children. So that was part of the success, that spiritually we felt called as church, as parish, to welcome people. And we didn't understand what it meant at the time. And I tell the community, I think it was a very prophetic experience and moment when we said we were going to welcome all God's children. Because within 2 or 3 months after we, you know, finished this whole planning process, that literally we had several South Sudanese families come knocking on the door and saying, we're looking for a church. And along with them was one of their leaders who says, here, Father, he goes all excited. My name is Bo, and I'm a catechist. I'm a certified catechist, and I'm here to serve. And so we begin with this refugee community. And I think it was so surprising to me how the parish just embraced the community, embraced the South Sudanese in every way that we could to help them feel at home so that they had time to be at church. I gave them a key. I took my key out of my pocket. And in a ritual way, real public way, handed the key to their leader and said, you have a home. So people saw this and it brought in, you know, the African community with their drums, their style of music. And people really enjoyed it in general. Now, there's another serious issue that nationally, Dominic, and of course in our parish, in our Episcopal region, Region 10, Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas, that I've begun to work personally is that we do a lot of work and we emphasize bringing in, you know, the new people. But we haven't done a good job of preparing the host community to integrate them into, you know, the church. And so I began to accompany and listen to a lot of the people that were uncomfortable with the change, that might have been even angry. You know, there's a sense of loss, there's pain in making room for the new people. They're afraid. You know, they're uncomfortable with a different language, a different culture. I have to learn to be intentional in creating space, even for them, in their own parish home, so they can be honest about what they feel, and we begin to understand them as well. So on both sides, it's a challenge, and I call it the heart work, H-E-A-R-T, not H-A-R-D, although it's very difficult. It's hard also, but it's about the heart on both sides. And to, you know, bottom line is to not be afraid of it. You know, diversity is a gift. people are coming with different cultures. They bring gifts to the church, to the parish, to our own lives. And the only thing that we really should be afraid of and uncomfortable with is the sin and the consequences of our sin in the midst of trying to make room and accommodate in all people in our parishes.
This makes me want to ask about an event that St. Joseph's is hosting. It's called an Intercultural Disciple-Making Sunday. And I've seen you describe it as a multilingual, multicultural day of formation. Is this a regular effort or something relatively new? And I guess sort of just based on some of what you were saying a moment ago, how do you promote it? How do you get people to come in the context of a shared parish? How do you get buy-in from all the communities, I guess, is another way to think about it.
Yeah, it is relatively new. You know, I have to explain that after my first term here, we did a second listening session, and we felt really moved by the Spirit to add to our mission statement. Not only are we a community that welcomes all God's children, we make disciples. And that sense of mission of making disciples, we've been working at it for over 6 years. And, you know, that's a change of culture for me as a pastor, for us as a parish community. But in all the efforts that we've experienced in trying to understand what that means for us to be disciples and make disciples, I discovered that when you focus on that sense of mission, who we are as church, then it makes it a lot easier. Now, there doesn't mean we haven't had some difficulties throughout the years in trying to have, for example, a trilingual Christmas midnight mass or a trilingual Holy Saturday celebration. You know, and even trying to teach people at the English Mass to sing a bilingual hymn so we can be ready for the times we're together at the Spanish community, teaching them a hymn in English so they can also join. And even the South Sudanese teaching us some of their hymns. I mean, we've worked at it for years. But when we begin to focus on all of us are called the disciples, then it occurred to us, this is a wonderful opportunity for us to come together as church. And we come on a Sunday where we come not as the 8, you know, in the morning group or the 10 o'clock group or the 12 or the mass group that I normally go to, but we all come together as one parish. And we learn about what it means to be a disciple of Christ. And so generally our theme is, you know, their disciple-making Sundays. We had one at the beginning of Advent. And it was very successful. We focused on our personal relationship with the Lord and how we witness to that. And so we separated in language groups to be able to do the catechesis. And then we come together to pray and sing and then give testimony. The next one that's coming up, we're going to focus on the family being the bedseat of disciple making. And so we have somebody going to speak in Spanish, somebody's going to speak in English, and then I will take the catechist and I will speak in English and they'll translate to Dinka for the South Sudanese. But it's beautiful. We come together, you know, for welcome and introductions and opening prayer. And then we introduce the speakers. We split up in the language groups. Then we come back together for testimonies and a final blessing. And then we have a reception. And, you know, food brings us together. It doesn't matter what food it is. We're able to be there together. You know, the different language groups and, you know, the children running around, we're all together and just having a good time.
I want to turn a little bit to some of the quantitative aspects of being in charge or overseeing a shared parish. And your parish has been identified by the USCCB as having achieved a high level of ecclesial integration. I'm wondering if you could tell us how something like that's determined. I mean, what are the qualities and characteristics? And what do you consider to be a high level of ecclesial integration?
I think one of the ways that I would begin as a pastor, not necessarily as part of that study, but as a pastor, you know, when I began to see that people across the board are not only supporting the parish in their own particular way, but they feel comfortable coming to the table and influencing decisions that are being made. I think a community is fully integrated when you have, in our case, the three larger groups are the South Sudanese, Mexican immigrant, and the Euro-American and Mexican-American. I'll put them together. They're mostly English-speaking. All three groups sit, for example, in our finance council. They sit at our pastoral council. These are the two most influential bodies in the parish. They get a place at the table to say, look, Father, this is what's going on with us. And then they're able to challenge each other. Look at that study that USCCB did. They begin with just the general understanding of what a shared parish is. We had an idea. There was one pastor, you know, serving several people, groups of people of different language groups, different cultures, but you didn't have like a second priest working with a specific nationality. So it's one priest. And so that somehow we're having to negotiate working, you know, with each group and sharing the space. In the process, they identified 20 pastors that were doing this work. And we began to see some things that we have in common. And just in general, I mean, that's a wonderful resource that you can get from USCCB that identifies 9 steps to ecclesial integration. And the first 3 steps, I call them giant steps, is about welcoming, giving people a place to feel and call their home. And the second 3 steps are not only, you know, having a sense of being welcomed, but now I belong. And so that I can begin to influence decisions that leads to the, you know, the third giant step is to a commitment to stewardship and communion. Now, all that is spelled out in that book with the individual steps in between. But what happened is that we had to report to USCCB all the things we're doing in the parish. And then they had somebody at the UCCB office look at the 20 parishes that they studied, and they were able to find evidence of all 9 steps at St. Joseph's. And so that's the way it's been working. So now we're using it as a way to teach people. You know, like these are, in general, some of the things that the steps we have to go through to see a high level of ecclesial integration. Now, that's where I begin aware in becoming, you know, a little bit more conscious of these steps, and or we could call it even movements, where I have felt, and maybe some of us doing this kind of ministry have felt, is that we have not been attentive enough to the host community and the steps they go through in order to continue the integration. Because a lot of times we think of integration, the way people see it in practice is more assimilation. And integration means that not only do the newcomers have to learn a new way of being church while holding on to some things, but the host also has to let go of some things and make room for the other. And that's very painful.
I just want to say for our listeners too, the study we're referring to is from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. It's called Best Practices for Shared Parishes So That They May All Be One Bilingual, which I guess was put together in 2014. And from the way you're describing it, Father, it does sound like this guide is meant to make these recommendations transferable to other parishes and settings.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to get back a little bit too, because you do raise the subject of the painfulness sometimes associated with integration. And, you know, and I guess that can occasionally lead to tensions as well. I know I've spoken to some sociologists who study the issue of shared parishes, and it seems like inevitably there will be tensions, there will be some conflict. And I guess, what do you recommend to some of your colleagues elsewhere in other communities about dealing with these instances of conflict and tension?
Yes. I think one of the most important things I'm learning to do, and I really, this is still a work in progress, we could say, learning how to be a good pastor, a good priest. After 13 years, I feel like, oh my gosh, I'm still learning so much. And it's actually exciting for me. But one of the most significant things is that I have to remember as a pastor to give each group the opportunity to be themselves. That is key. It's not just celebrating their feast days and, you know, their the way they socialize and the way they learn and study and all the cultural stuff that we're so aware of, but to give each people the space to even struggle in this process of integration. So I think the first thing is to recognize that the people need that space. And so, like, for example, the Year American or the Integrated Mexican America needs opportunities to vent, to be angry and uncomfortable. And there's nothing wrong with that. And that we'd be willing as priests and as pastoral leaders in the parish, the whole staff, we have to be willing to accompany, you know, the different groups. And sometimes it's individuals, because sometimes it's the leader or a few leaders within the group. We create the space for them to just be themselves, but then we choose to also accompany them through the process. So it's literally walking with them, going to their meetings, you know, being a part of the conversation, but really in a very pastoral, passive way to listen, not to go and tell them where they need to be or should be, but to acknowledge, you know, where they're at is okay, as long as they keep moving towards that integration. So consistently giving them those opportunities to understand themselves in the process. And when they're ready, and it's really, you know, it's not easy because you have to discern when people are ready. But when they're ready to begin to encourage them, okay, can you reach out to the other group? Or let me tell a little bit about the other group, why they do the things that they do, the way they do them. So you begin to kind of connect them and become a bridge between the group you're with at the moment and the group that they're struggling with. So it takes a lot of pastoral skills of listening and accompanying, taking time to be with them and not react. You know, all of us, we have to learn to do that better. I would say that this is the most difficult thing for me to deal with. And it's sad because some choose not to participate in the process and they regrettably leave the parish.
I also want to let my colleague Milton Bravo, I want to bring him in too to talk about some of the other things and some of the other challenges and issues you might be facing at St. Joseph's.
That's right. Thank you, Father Hector, for being with us. The National Hispanic Ministry Encuentro process that just concluded fairly recent provided the American Catholicism the synodal type of process that allows for a broad consultation among bishops, priests, lay ministers, and the people of God. And I wonder if you could describe in your parish, perhaps in your diocese, the Encuentro process in terms of the strengths and weaknesses of the Encuentro. And I wonder also if this was primarily Hispanic-led in your parish, given the fact that you do have so many different communities.
It was a very positive, exciting experience for us, not only in my parish, but in the diocese. We didn't have a large number of people participating at any level, but the few people that did respond were, you know, instrumental because they began then to replicate some of the experience that they've had. I was part of the national team from the beginning, so that helped me understand the process. And so I knew that we were concerned, which is really significant. It's no longer just what the church in the United States can offer the Hispanic Latino community, but what can the Hispanic Latino do to better serve the church? And so with that kind of mindset, I knew it wasn't just for Hispanics. And so I was able to introduce it to the parish, and we ended up having two significant groups in the parish. And it's interesting at St. Joseph's, the smaller one was in Spanish and mostly immigrant. The larger group was English, and it reflected all the other the English-speaking groups. But the beauty of it, it was five sessions, and in those sessions, we had opportunities to go out on mission, which was key. And so that's what I mean. It might have been a small number of people, but the people who came had an experience of what Pope Francis is calling us to missionary discipleship. And being in a parish, we'd been speaking about discipleship, it just makes sense. So bottom line, what Encuentro did for us, not only here in our parish, in the diocese, and even the regional and national experience, was that it gave us an opportunity to reflect on who we are as people of God, not just as Latinos, but as people of God, and how we're called to become missionary disciples. And that experience is across the board. People who went through the process had, you know, the experience of going out into the streets, into the peripheries. So it was life-changing, you know, for us. In our own diocese, because we didn't have many parishes do it, the ones that did it here, and maybe four or five parishes were really a part of this, we created a team. And what we did is we sponsored like retreat style of this Encuentro process. So we had five sessions in one day. And again, it was well received. People were excited about it. And it really touch, you know, people's lives. And I've seen here at St. Joseph's, the people who went through that process are understanding where we're at now in forming disciples because they had that experience. And so we're trying to replicate that with all the groups.
And in perhaps a more general question beyond the Encuentro process, how can, given your experience, Hispanic ministry at all levels, regionally, nationally, change the perception that it only serves Latinos or Hispanics, from that perception to serving the entire church, that Hispanic ministry can provide something to the entire Catholic Church?
I'm very aware of that, and I've been working with that understanding for many, many years as I've been a national leader and as a regional leader, and especially diocese and parochial, is that when we speak to the families, when we speak to people in ministry, we consistently need to be reminding people we're here to serve the church. And I think we're getting it. I think people around the country are beginning to understand that we are simply called to be disciples of Christ, and we're here to serve the church. Now, there's certain things that makes us more comfortable, where, you know, for example, if we're just more Spanish speaking, we're going to be drawn to the Spanish speaking. But we keep saying, you know, but it's about the gospel. And so we're here to communicate the good news to all people. So what is that going to take? And we understand that language doesn't have to be a barrier. We use it as an excuse, as a barrier all the time, because we can minister to people sometimes without saying a word. It's the way we greet people, the way we approach people, the way we accompany people. You know, it's very important. So it's really educating our own people to recognize that we're here to serve the whole church.
One of the interesting facts from the Encuentro process was the emphasis on the different generational aspects of the Hispanic community. First generation Hispanics make up 18% of U.S. Catholics. The second generation comes in around 12%, and third generation beyond comes in at 9% of the U.S. Catholics. And I wonder, given your attention to the cultural diversity in your parish, I wonder if you see some of these generational differences and how they play into your ministry and that of your team.
Since last June, we've been talking about this with the pastoral council and trying to understand, you know, what the different generations need and how they, you know, seek God and how they're trying to develop their own spirituality is different from what we're accustomed to. And so we've had a lot of discussions, and to summarize it, it's led us after 6 months for me to have said, this is happening now. You know, I guess it was in December when I finally told the pastoral council, look around, look at who's at the table right now. We've done very good about incorporating and integrating all the different ethnic groups, but not, you know, the younger people. We had some listening sessions where we evaluated, you know, our hospitality, our hymns, and our homilies. And there it surfaced that very clearly that this generational differences is an issue for us that it's serious enough and we need to address. And so concretely, we begin to try to understand, you know, how are they different? And what I've read and conferences I've been to, my general understanding is that younger generations are seeking authenticity, community, and purpose. And so with that general idea, we begin to talk with the pastoral council and the pastoral staff and the volunteers. What's absolutely of importance to us is the most essential thing is that we're not going to talk about them. We're going to talk with them. And so it just so happens that today I have my last meeting with the pastoral council that does not include a lot of the young people. And so I've come up with a new structure where we're going to begin to discern new members. And one of the requirements is that a third of the pastoral council must reflect this younger generation.
As you may be aware, ongoing systemic injustices are experienced by the Hispanic community, including a lack of affordable healthcare, access to education, the criminal justice system, the broken immigration system, and the housing crises. And I just wonder, given your experience, what should be a strategic response by national voices, such as the USCCB Subcommittee for Hispanic Affairs, or perhaps even the current president of the USCCB, Archbishop Gomez, to assist Hispanic communities throughout the U.S.?
I think that's a wonderful question, and I wish I had Archbishop Gomez, who I know him real well, sitting right here next to me. But I think what we need to work on as a conference, as priests, as pastor leaders in the church today, in truly focusing on forming and educating our families and young people, not just on the doctrine of the church, the truth, which is absolutely necessary, but across the board, all these social issues, and not really kind of separate ourselves to the point where this is church and that's, you know, society or that's government, but really begin to bring the issues to our parish life where we can talk about them. And so that we, as church people, whether we're Hispanic or not, that we can go out into the streets and to try to influence the decisions that are being made, whether it's, you know, any of those things that you mentioned, education or health, family life, you know, immigration issues, so that we can take on the leadership in informing and influencing the people of power so that we can make these necessary societal changes.
We've been talking with Father Hector Madrigal, the pastor of St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Amarillo, Texas. And Father, I just really want to thank you for spending time with us today. This has been a great conversation.
This has been really wonderful, Father.
Thank you.
If parishes are changing, so too are parishioners. Our April issue features the voices of several Catholics in the pews. Madeline Jarrett urges churches to be made more accessible. Tia Noel Pratt asks us to pay attention to African-American Catholics. And Griffin Olenek profiles the work of the Coalition for Spiritual and Public Leadership. Join us for the next episode, where we speak with Natalia Imperatore Lee, and Jason Steidel, and Molly Wilson O'Reilly about homilies, LGBTQ ministry, and bringing your children to church. That's next time on the Common Wheel Podcast. The Commonweal Podcast is produced by Assistant Editor Griffin Olenek and the Commonweal staff in partnership with Sandberg Media. Wally Boudway composed the music, and David Dalt did the editing. For the Commonweal Podcast, this is Dominic Preziosi.